So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm Nate Larkin.
I'm David Hampton.
Oh, man, what a day.
Yeah.
David, I just came from, swung by the Kroger on the way here and saw an old friend of ours. I don't know if you remember from back in the day, Daniel Razum. Do you remember?
Yeah, yes.
Street musician, black street musician. It turns out, you know, he and I have become good friends. We have a lot in common. We're pretty much exactly the same age, and we're both preacher's kids. We have our differences. You know, mm-hmm. I'm white, he's black. I'm fat, he's skinny. I've got hair, he's bald.
Uh-huh.
He's musically talented. I'm not. He's done some time since the last time you saw him.
Right.
But he just has that same winsome personality. It's as though he got in touch with God in a different way while he was inside.
Mm. Yeah.
He's got some real wisdom. You know what? I went over there to just kind of encourage him because he'd set up. He was playing outside of Kroger.
Oh, okay.
And I went to encourage him, and instead I got encouraged.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
We have a lot to learn from people that, I don't know about you, but one of the marks of active addiction for me was this arrogance that I carried around. I was disguising my sense of inferiority, but I just dismissed people all the time.
Right.
I think that's a symptom of self-centeredness and
mm-hmm.
pride.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a good listener. I wasn't a good learner.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly wouldn't have spent much time with people who I considered marginal.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we've got a guest today who has quite a life, quite an influence. He's found life and recovery going after a different crowd than the one he pursued during his years of active using.
That's right. And a different crowd than he pursued as a working musician and artist.
Yeah. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
It's not to say that we shouldn't spend time with the pretty people.
Mm-hmm.
But I have learned that there is much to be gained when we turn our attention to the people who aren't necessarily pretty.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's part of our service.
Yeah. And what we find, at least what I find, is unexpected beauty in those places.
Right. And I find myself.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. It's interesting, in the rooms of recovery, you hang out with people that you wouldn't have picked.
Right.
Isn't that true?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The best friends that you're going to make are probably so different from you, from everything from, the way they express themselves to how they present themselves.
Yeah. And it really is fun to just kind of open up all the possibilities for friendship.
Right.
And to see those deep similarities between our cosmetic differences and to find, you know, to make really soul connections.
Yeah.
Deep connections. All right. Well,
I'm excited about our upcoming guest.
Oh, I am. I am. Nathan Lee has become a really, really good friend of mine over the years. And the things that he's doing in his nonprofit work with prisoners and prisons, bringing music. It's called Send Musicians to Prison.
Send Musicians to Prison.
Yeah, okay. You got to love it. I mean, because I've heard a few and I thought he definitely should be sent to prison. But it's a different take on that. And but what he also has now is they are working on a curriculum for helping people who are incarcerated manage everything from their anger to their money.
Wow.
Because we just don't have the tools when we don't have the experience.
Yeah.
And we're finding that these people come out and they don't have the skills and the tools to live in what we'd call mainstream society. And this is preparing them to live in mainstream society, all the while working on sobriety, working on what it means to live a sober life,
yeah.
and taking some beauty into a place that is pretty void of it otherwise.
Well, I'm looking forward to an unfiltered conversation.
It is unfiltered.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know about you, but my experience is that in recovery, as my behavior got better, my language got worse.
Yeah, my language has always been kind of bad. But I'll tell you one of the freeing things for me, and this probably won't surprise anybody, when I learned that I could use certain words in the context of prayer, because God actually... he viewed that as my sincerity,
yeah.
Demonstrating my sincerity,
yeah.
So to speak. That I had a much more honest encounter spiritually.
Yeah, yeah. I was always very, very, very careful with my language. I mean, during my years of active addiction, it was part of my dishonesty.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Even when I was, effing around, I would never say the F word. And yeah, I even phrased that carefully.
Uh-huh.
I think for me, the pendulum's starting to swing a little bit back.
Yeah.
Kind of in my freedom and authenticity, there were a few years where I was kind of gratuitous in my language.
Yeah. Well, and I'll tell you this. This is true confessions here today, I guess. But I have clients who, as we talk in recovery about the spiritual principles and surrendering and so on and so forth, and they tell me they can't pray. You know, they just cannot. They cannot pray. Can't develop a conversation with God. And I said, well, maybe you think that it's preaching to God that he wants to hear whatever. And so I just ask them if they have a sunroof, and they often say, yeah, I do. And I'll just say, well, here's, open the sunroof and yell the F word as loud as you can out the sunroof, and that counts. Start with that, get it out of your system,
yeah.
And then, because God hears that as prayer.
Yelling at prayer, or yelling at God, is a valid form of prayer.
Absolutely.
If you don't believe it, go to the Psalms.
Absolutely.
All right, I'm getting my preacher on.
Well, no, you're not, because you'd be kicked out of any church that you just said that in. And so would I.
All right. Well, let's bring him in then. Let's have a conversation with Nathan Lee. And welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And Dave Hampton has brought another one of his colorful friends.
Absolutely. That is the best way to say that.
Of course, I've met Nathan before, but have not had the privilege of an extended conversation, and I've been looking forward to this one for a couple of weeks. So go ahead, David, introduce Nathan for us.
Well, this is my friend Nathan Lee, and Nathan is a very talented musician and recording artist, songwriter, and guy that has been doing this for a long time. And like all of us, has a really interesting story about the way he came to the end of himself.
Mm.
And Nathan and I got to walk together through some of that. And I have gotten to be just really great friends with him. And so now he's one of my, what are you doing for dinner, buddies?
Nice.
And but he also has a great work that he's doing with taking music into prisons, working with hospice care in prison. He has a heart for people that are underserved in many, many ways. And I'll let him talk about that with us a little bit. But Nathan, welcome and thank you again.
Thanks
just
for having me.
Yeah. Making time.
Yeah, it's so cool to be here. Thank you.
Yeah.
Would you give us a little bit of backstory, Nathan? Tell us a little bit about your growing up, your love for music and where it took you.
Growing up was in the Northeast U.S., mm-hmm. New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. I grew up around music. My father was a musician, had a recording studio.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, so after school, weekends, I came home, and I was just from a young age.
Yeah,
exposed
yeah.
to all of that.
What kind of music did your dad do?
He was a musician when he was younger, and then uh-huh. eventually had to feed the family.
Oh, I
so,
see.
So, you know, and went on to build a studio, and then we just grew up. A lot of bands out of Manhattan would come out to PA, and for everything, rock.
A
lot of rock bands. And would just spend the whole week in the house. And the first floor of the house was the studio. We lived on the second floor. And so I'd get up for school in the morning and step over dirty rock and roll musicians for my mom to make breakfast.
Okay. So it wasn't chamber music?
No.
No, okay. All right.
And my parents grew up in the 60s, you know, so everything that goes with that,
yeah.
all the stereotypes. Early 70s happened, the Jesus movement.
Uh-huh.
And so they became radical Christians. So the pendulum swung from the one side all the way to the other side.
Okay.
So it was a shit show for a few years. Plus, my parents had kids young as teenagers, so they were kids raising kids.
Right.
You know, and it's almost now as you see us with our parents in some conversations as though we're peers.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And at the same time, they're our parents, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they've done a great job. They're coming up on 50 years, but there was just a lot of dysfunction that nobody really had tools for or understood the language to.
Sure.
So we've all had to find our way.
Yeah.
You know, it's been tricky. So...
How many siblings?
Two siblings, an older brother,
okay.
younger sister, and I've got middle child syndrome.
All right. Okay.
Whatever the hell that means.
Yeah.
Excelled in school?
Horrible in school. Skipped uh-huh. 72 days my senior year and went to rehab. But I was more interested in feelings and music.
Right.
You know, I was really emotionally based and wanted to create music that could let that out.
Were you already performing in high school?
I was. I started performing, I think, at like 14. I sang in my brother's band, and then I started playing in the city, but I was a minor.
Mm-hmm.
So to get in bars, my dad would go and run sound.
Okay.
And then that was still back in the day where a lot of clubs, you had to bring your own production.
Oh, wow.
You brought your whole front of house sound, did your 4 hours.
Really?
You like really had to work.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, I loved it, and that's what we did, and my dad grew up doing it, so it was just kind of a natural flow in that regard.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were on Star Search.
You're an asshole.
I just had to throw it out there. I thought we'd get that out of there. And then
I love you, David.
The elephant in the room, and then we can move on.
You know how that happened was while I was in rehab at 17, a friend of mine sent a demo in uh-huh. to Star Search. And the day I got home, I shit you not, I got a call to come do an audition. And I did. I went and did the audition, and like 2 weeks later, into some version of sobriety, I went and did that show.
Wow. Yeah.
That was like in 91.
Yeah.
92. I was out of my mind. But yes, it happened. You probably YouTube it somewhere. It's so embarrassing. I was a maniac.
Okay. All right. You got any taste of grandiosity during those years?
Probably
for you?
In every way. I mean, like you're talking to an addict. So how do you mean that?
I mean, did you start to imagine that you were like God's gift to the world?
I knew I was.
Uh-huh.
I was certain of it.
Mm. Yeah.
I didn't know what the word narcissism was or ego.
Yeah.
I didn't know any of that. But yeah, I think that early age, I set out on a path of you're either in what I do with me or you're in my way.
Wow.
Mm. And that mm-hmm. was it.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, a trail of tears behind me for the next two decades, really.
Yeah.
I had a song, get a band, go.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. it just became a shitstorm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was fun, too, in all the wrong ways. Does that make sense?
I hear you.
Okay.
Yeah. When did you decide, Nathan, that it wasn't okay to be you?
When it wasn't okay to be me?
Mm-hmm. Like, when it wasn't safe, like, and you needed to escape being you.
Well, subconsciously, I think that's my whole life. I haven't felt safe to be me.
Mm-hmm.
When I knew it wasn't safe to be me was a year and a half ago.
Mm.
Am I answering?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Correctly? Yeah. So, yeah.
If you're answering honestly, you're answering correctly.
That's right. There's no right answer other than the honest one. So it's
so I've always known, right, because I'm a closet addict. So that in itself, that's a mess. You just spend your whole life dancing around in shadows and manipulating and lying and maneuvering with people. It's just horrible. And then, you know, if you outlive that, one day you wake up and you have to figure out, I will continue this or not do this. So.
I really resonate with the closet addict description as somebody who grew up in a Christian home. Mm-hmm. My dad was a pastor, and then I went on to become a professional Christian for a time. It would have been absolutely fatal for me to admit publicly, at least in my own mind, that I was doing what I was doing. Is that part of your story as well?
Absolutely. So I had a great upbringing. Mm-hmm. Like, even with my parents being kids, raising kids, they did a stellar job. When you do the math, they're badasses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I had all the things, you know, dinner every night and blah, blah, blah. But it was somehow, the word legalism has always kind of resonated in the shadows of what I know in white Christian world.
Yeah.
And it can look different and smell different because of whatever culture or church you might be in at the moment. But once I kind of realized that and stopped being angry about it and stopped pointing blame, I realized to be transparent, there was no place to do so in the world I grew up without shame.
Right.
That's what really allowed me to stay in a closet addict.
Right, sure.
Yeah, I don't want to carry all this, but sure, you know what happens when somebody gets caught.
Yeah, right.
I don't want to be around for that.
Yeah.
So really my entry into rehab as a teenager and I got out taught me that I had to be better at hiding. Mm-hmm. That was round one taught me I've got to up my game. And I did. I became really good at it.
Yeah.
Like the one thing when I got clean a year and a half ago was the one thing I do best is lie. And I would tell you that I don't lie.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's a hard reality. And then to be around people that say, I'm going to love you in that. We're not ashamed of it. Like, hey, you got friends in that language.
Yes.
What?
Yeah.
But I didn't grow up that way. I didn't even know that was available. I didn't know that we could sit and talk like this.
Yeah.
Or that somebody that might listen to this could say, hey, I might be able to find a road to walk in recovery that there's a way to release all the stuff within me and I will not be shamed. I'll be loved more.
Yeah.
So I think that that message of growing up in church was there, but I wasn't experiencing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Nobody, you know, as much as unconditional love of God is real, don't get caught.
Yeah.
Right.
And I was like, well, this is a fucking mess.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And we have lots of grace for ex-addicts.
Yeah. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the ex-addict moniker. Because when you sit down and you have conversations like this, like we are right now, we all know that we still are like one click from just being completely back to square one.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And it's sobering and frightening and off-putting and all of that. But yeah, you know, we can sit and have conversations about the ways that we saw the world and still see the world in, at times that made up who we are and who we became, and that somehow that's played into the things we are doing now. Mm. And I don't know.
So you got bands, you've got songs, life on the road, I imagine. Touring musician?
Yes.
Okay.
Dirty style. Vans.
Uh-huh.
Only, you know, my glass ceiling as an artist, commercially speaking, was low. I got to open for a couple tours that were good tours.
Yeah.
So occasionally I'd pay to be on the bus, you know.
Yeah.
But yes, all the stuff, sex, drugs, rock and roll, I wanted to find out if it all was true, and it all was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was there something addictive about being able to get in the van and leave this town and go to the next town and then go to the next town and the next town? Or did that eventually just become such a blur? I'm just wondering about the... I know that there's this common addict mindset that I certainly share, which is if I can change my surroundings, I can change my life. So if I'm not sitting still, that's why it's good to be on the road and good touring. It's good to be in front of a new crowd tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. It's a reset. Mm-hmm. Any of that or not?
Totally. I mean, if there's no better, worse cousin for the addict than touring. I'm an addict. Let's go. Yeah. No matter what I do, I'll be out of there within 24 hours.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, and it's so it's you remove yourself from intimacy, really.
Yeah.
And if you are within a community of brotherhood, sister, whatever, touring musicians,
yeah,
if you all know how to respect each other's dysfunction, it can go on a lifetime.
Oh, wow. Mm.
It's noisy, it's loud, it's passive, it's painful, and you just keep going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And everybody wakes up somewhere at some point in some hotel, whether it's 5-star or crap, and you have enough.
Yeah.
And you just, however, you know, our stories are all so different, but it becomes exhausting. Mm-hmm. You know, and physically, like, I'm 43 now, so people, you know, you always hear, wait till you turn 40, wait till you turn 50. There's some basic math that your body just one day doesn't do what it did.
Yeah.
And yeah, it starts to happen. So all of a sudden, like, you, like, cheeseburgers have to turn into yogurt. And it's, you know, the sexy starts wearing off, the cool starts wearing off. You're, to keep up with your addiction is just crazy. And, you know, you make your community of who you pick up and buy from over the years if you're on the road long enough. And you're surrounded by yes people. So they're just going to yes you that. So if you want whatever to pill, to shoot up, drink, they'll get it for you. Mm-hmm. Just keep the train on the rails and keep the money coming in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So... And you know, the problem too, the bigger an artist gets, that can become a bigger problem, a massive problem.
Sure, sure.
And it's a house of cards the bigger you get. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I spent 20 years of my life or more doing all that hiding.
Yeah.
Picking up pills in the most random places from somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just so I could forget what city I was in.
Yeah.
How did you approach, Nathan, the day that you realize that you might just have to be average in order to be sober?
I'm still in denial. because I don't feel like we don't have to be average, but we really are. Like, yesterday I was with a group of college students speaking about my work, which was an honor, and I was sharing. I feel like so much of my life now is a messenger of, I'm just telling people what my therapist says. They'll be like, wow, that's brilliant. I'm like, you can't. I can take no ownership. I'm trying to understand it. But one of the things I was taught last year is, it's a double-edged sword. You are not as important as you think you are, but you are more important than you think you are. Mm-hmm. And that paradox, my whole day is just dancing in that now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think, how would I say, how did you ask it? So I don't get too far down the rabbit trail.
Just about how you've adjusted to just maybe the need to be average, and everything not to be so big and on fire all the time. Everything doesn't have to be, you know, mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a tour,
right,
in order to turn your crank. And walking the dogs can actually be a good day.
It can. I think.
And I met your dogs, by the way, and they're
badass, right?
They're badass and charming.
Everybody in recovery should have an animal to walk.
That's right.
I think for me, I am a bit of an adrenaline junkie. Mm-hmm. I don't want to miss out on life. There's some hardwire in me that feels like every day has got to be on 10. So what I've done with that is in the last 18 months, I look at projects now. So instead of standing in a room full of crazy lights, it's called addiction and unhealthy thinking, I'll put dartboards on the wall and I focus. So I have to have that. I'm wired to know, like, you know, I spend so much of my time mastering the art of hiding. There's a lot of maneuvers that have to be played with your money and lying and getting across town to get this drug or not get caught having that drink, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So what do I do with all that energy? Mm-hmm. So I remember early in recovery, David said to me, you have to learn how to be bored. And I thought, fuck you.
Yeah.
Like, no, you said it.
I knew. I was like, that is the dumbest shit I've ever. No.
Yeah.
Sober or not, that's a horrible theory. But I got what he was saying.
Yeah.
And I asked him, like, what does that look like? And he said, go to a food court in a mall and just sit there with your laptop.
Yeah.
I'm like, no. But I understood the point you were getting at. Mm-hmm. So I think the beautiful part of recovery for me thus far is just being honest about who I am. So I know I love a rush, but I have to figure out what to do with that. Mm-hmm. So I have projects. I put them into my work. Mm-hmm. I put them into my day in small windows. So you bring up the idea of walking dogs. Mm-hmm. I actually look forward to that now.
Yeah.
It's something I have to do.
Yeah.
It's just, that's part of my, that's my little rush.
Yeah.
It's weird, but it's.
Yeah, I remember my first sponsor telling me that boring is good, and it made no sense to me.
Right.
I also thought that I hated routine, even though my acting out was highly ritualistic. I got up every day and did the same thing. Mm-hmm. And my sponsor was pushing a healthy routine, which I resisted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's different for all of us, right? I mean, we all, I think that's the beautiful thing, that we can make recovery our own. I'm still selfish enough that I want to.
Yeah.
But it's a healthy thing now.
Yeah. Well, it's, and for me, it was because I thought recovery was about not drinking.
Yes.
So I kept waiting for the not drinking part. You're giving me all this stuff to do, but when are you going to get to the part where it's actually about not drinking?
Yeah.
And, you know, my first response, it was just like, if not drinking is what you want out of this, this is not going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not what sobriety is.
Yeah.
New way of being, believing, experiencing life. And as a result, your need to use will diminish. But of course it's going to take intentionality and things like that. But yeah, I kept waiting on the handbook on the 5 steps to the not drinking instructions where it would kick in. But
Nathan, so you've got a nonprofit now, which with a great name, just a fantastic name. Send Musicians to Prison. Is that?
That's it.
Okay.
Send Musicians to Prison.
And you have done that as an active addict and as a sober addict.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to hear, first of all, how that whole train got rolling.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd also like to hear how your experience of that work has changed.
Okay.
In sobriety.
So my whole life I was an artist, right? And making messes, blowing record deals, publishing deals. Just I was a master of getting in my own way.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess nearly 10 years ago, I was in another record deal. And the one time that I made a lot of messes in that record deal, that whole scenario. But I got a call from a lawyer one day that said, your record company went out of business. Well, I'm on the road.
Which means
there's no more road float. There's nothing. So the tour comes to an end. I'm in L.A. I go on a 4-day bender with the last of the money. And I was in a hotel in Hollywood. And a buddy of mine called me up. And he's a guy from Nashville that now lived in L.A.
Uh-huh.
He's actually from Africa. He moved from Africa, got a record deal, and he was the dude that we'd go out, and he was so ballsy. He would do put lines out on the bar.
Wow.
Bro, let's do some more, mate. And this is like crazy.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not really his accent, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
And so fast forward all these years, you know, this was what people maybe call a God moment. It surely wasn't coincidence. He called me one morning and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm in L.A., and I'm praying over the toilet right now. And I was a mess. You know, my ego was mess. You know, when you're in your early 30s and you lose a record deal, you think it's the end of the world. You're embarrassed. And
right.
He said, I'm going to come get you. I'm going to play a jail and I have a chaplain's pass, which is a very random thing that somebody can just take you the day of.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the day my life changed. I don't know how it all worked out. I still think back about it all the time. And he took me into this jail. We sat down in a jail. And there's 300 guys in L.A. County, just gangsters. And you've got nothing to hide behind. No lights, no production. No, it's your instrument, 2 speakers. It's everything you hope doesn't happen in your life as an artist.
Right. Yeah.
And you have nothing to hide behind. And I'm not a gangster. And all I have were my songs. And I wrote a lot as an artist from places of pain. It was a release for me. That's how I went into art. And when I was done with that first song, whatever the moment I was waiting for was, whatever that Grammy Award moment, that was the moment.
Wow.
Mm. I was like, this is it. I'm going to be with these people and write for them. I need them. They need to be reminded they matter.
Yeah.
And off went the train running. But to remind you, I'm still a full-blown addict behind all this.
Sure.
So, you know, some of my really nice white Christian friends go, isn't that beautiful that God still used you in the midst of your sin? And I'm like, fuck off. That's the shit that got me into this.
That's
not how this story is going.
But
I understand their empathy.
Sure.
But, you know, and so I was in so much pain. And really, you know, the old saying of hurt people, hurt people. I was like, really what I was is in a room full of dysfunction and I was accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I had nothing to offer other than that one. I knew I mattered, but I didn't know how to do the work. I was too afraid to do the work.
Yeah.
So there's a long story that played out over the next 10 years of a nonprofit was brought to life.
Yeah.
I toured prisons, max blocks around the country for years, became exhausted, started inviting friends in, and the organization started to grow. And I realized there were skill sets needed to run a nonprofit that I didn't have, which brings us to the second half of your question. How did you ask?
Well, how did your experience change?
Okay. It changed because, so I was very mathematical with my substance use. So my drug of choice was Klonopin. Mm-hmm. And I got to full, you know, I was at 20 milligrams at the end. So I was maxed out on full dosage and it wasn't working. And I was functional.
Yeah.
So I was a functional addict.
Right.
And I knew the math of when to take what at what points in the day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The big thing was you don't go hard in the morning because you got to put on a tie and act like you know what the hell you're talking about.
Right.
And I always knew in my mind, if I started using in the mornings, that's when things would be bad. So I never did until right. the end. So a year and a half ago, my workload was intense. I was balancing all of these things in my first grown-up job.
Yeah.
I'm not being creative. So that was all suppressed. And I found myself using in the morning. And it was as true as what I thought. I was really, you know, most addicts, there's a science behind it unless you truly just don't give a shit. You know?
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh. yeah.
And I guess the big wake-up call for me was knowing at some point this basic math says this will go off the rails. Mm-hmm. And it did, but the brilliant part is it didn't go off the rails in a point where the entire thing hit the news headlines.
Yeah.
I received a call from my accountant one day and said, how did you spend $150 or $200 in the Detroit airport bar this weekend? And I said, I wasn't in Detroit. So she figured out I was in Detroit. I still to this day don't remember.
Oh, wow.
Went mm-hmm. on a 4-day bender. Anyway, so much of it was stress, pain, no language, mm-hmm. no tools. Another Monday morning she calls me and, what are all these charges? I don't remember being in any of those places. And okay. I knew it was time to do something. So as David taught me early in recovery, right after this, we met shortly thereafter, and he said, you blew your own whistle. Mm-hmm. So you imagine in my position, what happened to me is I knew internally there was something as an addict that said, now you're playing Russian roulette.
Yeah.
I don't know why that happened to me. Mm-hmm. I just, maybe it's because I've been around so many addicts and stories.
Yeah.
My biggest fear was to expose myself. I thought running a nonprofit that, so many people call a ministry and there's this rub because I'm like, what is it, ministry?
But yeah.
I get it. And I was, you know, there are people that put their money into this nonprofit with the hopes of other people experiencing hope.
Yeah.
To be reminded of the matter. I wasn't misappropriating funds. You know, I take a paycheck like anybody else that works at a nonprofit, but you know how that can look.
Sure.
You know, if you're giving to an organization and all of a sudden the guy's like, well, he got caught. You know, why?
Yeah.
And my mind was telling me, this is the end. But I have to go to you and you and you and tell you
yeah.
what has just happened. And I thought this will be how this plays out and done and whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the exact opposite happened. Mm-hmm. I experienced...
You didn't get crucified.
No, it was fucking mind-blowing.
Yeah.
The pastor of my church comes over and says, okay, you're going to... So my call was, I've got to get help. And so that was the day I made the call. I talked to my lawyer, mm-hmm. the board at the nonprofit, and blah, blah, you know, so everybody calms down. I make the calls to the donors the next day, and I start getting lit. Because, you know, the day you're going to go detox.
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's
the last hurrah.
The last day before the diet.
Yes, it's like the last day of spring break. You've got to do shit. And I started receiving all the phone calls, like, hey, I'm coming over. My church came over and said, we're going to pay for dog care.
Yeah.
Who thinks about paying for dog care? Nobody said, you know.
Yeah.
And everybody was the exact opposite. What do you need? What do you need? And I was like, yo, this is crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's what I always wanted. I thought I would never.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I went and I detoxed. And mm-hmm. then that was an old, interesting story to how that played out in recovery. But I will say, so in the last 18 months, you know, early recovery is crazy for all of us. But. Now, everything is super weird in the sense of being clean. I think nobody told me how weird getting clean would be. Mm-hmm. They just, it's like the secret they don't tell you. And I'm not here to discourage somebody from getting clean. I'm just saying, how do you really explain to somebody? Like yeah. I used to say in the first 90 days of not using, I never really had a reason to use until I got clean.
Yeah.
Now I had a reason to use because I could see everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Fucking mind blowing.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Like, how am I still alive? And why does anybody even talk to me? I'm such an asshole. you know? Give me a drink.
Yeah. yeah.
Or
yeah.
like David, I believe he was sitting in therapy and he would start breaking things down. I'm like, this is going to be so much fucking work to get out of this kind of pain.
Yeah.
Learn the tools, apply the tools. This is horrible. Uh-huh. So it's really hard. Recovery is really fucking hard. Mm-hmm. But so is... not being in recovery.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you weigh out the scales.
Yeah.
At least I was able to put the pistol down, per se.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm like, here it is. I'm exposed. So if somebody doesn't want to be my friend, fuck it. At least I don't have to live in pain anymore.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'll try to figure this out.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fascinated by the dynamics in prison. I loved the movie Walk the Line, Joaquin Phoenix playing Johnny Cash. I grew up listening to Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison live album, and that film ends with him just declaring that to his record company that he's going to do his next album live at Folsom, right? Mm-hmm. And you see him there, you see the connection between him, and you know that he's an active addict. But there was some connection for him, and I think maybe you explained it to me, that thing you felt the first time you went into. Did you continue to feel that connection with the audience as you toured throughout the years for those Max blocks? And has that changed in any way since getting clean?
You know, as an artist, so I don't play like I used to, mm-hmm. Especially in the last year and a half. I just needed to get away from my own noise, and I've only ever made music. I needed to learn how to listen.
Oh, wow.
To music, and just, you know, even now, like by today, I'll be done hearing my own voice for about 72 hours.
Okay.
I've spent my whole life hearing my own voice. It's a bit much, right? But when I sit in those rooms with those guys, you know, there's the whole people, well, the only difference is I didn't get caught. It's true. I didn't. I have no idea why I haven't done jail time.
Right.
Uh-huh. And that's not me trying to like shoulder up to some gangster.
Yeah.
I'm not a gangster. I don't know how to.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting to me in those rooms is, so I was a self-employed artist and I blew a lot of opportunities. I've met a lot of drug dealers in prison that are freaking brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
If
mm-hmm.
they had put that skill set on anything else.
Yeah.
You know, they're smart guys.
Yeah.
It's just basically, you know, the odds say at some point you most likely will get busted. So I felt like, even though I'm not a gangster, that guy's my friend. We're like two guys on the same street trying to run our businesses, our shop. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, right.
People that are in emotional pain. I have compassion for people who are in emotional pain. Now, the difference is now I don't live in that.
Yeah.
Because I've been given some tools and I can figure out within a few minutes that my feelings are not my reality.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So that's the difference now. I can put my feelings and emote into a song and step away from it. I don't have to keep living in it for the rest of the day. Like, we can go out and have dinner.
Yeah.
And life doesn't have to suck.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
But back then, life really, it was just a constant loop. And that's what I lived in because I did not explore the tools of how to break the loop.
Yeah.
And some of the things that have helped me now are really simple. I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to live in recovery because it was just too hard or I didn't have the strength. And I don't retain information. So not to insult myself, but I just wasn't the smart kid. I've never been the smart kid. I make a living through the refrigerator's empty, go find more food, figure it out, try mm-hmm. to stay legal. Mm-hmm. But I need bumper stickers. So quotes like, your feelings are not your reality, it's shit like that that keeps me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I've got to keep, what's, you know, keep it simple, stupid. Mm-hmm. Like, shit like that, I remember. Mm-hmm. Like, Nathan, you're not smart, and for the next 10 minutes, you can't put a pill or alcohol in your body.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what do? Walk the dogs, have a cigarette, blah, 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 blah.
And this too shall pass.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I feel like in the strangest way, I'm not going to say people that are incarcerated are my people. I think it's as much as that's a tough gig to live your life incarcerated.
Yeah.
Because I live so much of my life in emotional pain.
Mm-hmm.
I was safe there. Mm. Now it has turned. You know, I have a harder time staying for long hours in jail now mm-hmm. because I don't want to be unhappy. Mm-hmm. Just like as creatively as an artist in the last year, I don't want to write ballads.
Uh-huh.
I don't. Mm-hmm. Like, I used to make fun of country songs that were about trucks. Now give me a fucking song about a truck. I just, you know, like, I actually want to see, like, the next half of my life, what could it actually look like being happy?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I know sad and I know substance abuse.
Yes.
Will you sit in a lot of pain with people beyond just, you know, bringing music in or, you know, interacting? You actually spend a lot of time with guys in hospice in prison, mm. and they are like the forgotten of the forgotten. I mean, nobody wants to deal with death, but when you're in prison and facing death, mm-hmm. and you can't even get to family, or you can't get a word to someone that you have that one last loved one. And that's part of where you spend your time. How in the world and why in the world would you spend time in that environment?
You know, I ask myself a lot, and I don't know how long I'll do it. You know, Send Musicians to Prison really started just as, let's get to the back of the prisons that no one will go to and give them music. Yeah. And it still is that. Yeah. That's the bulk of our heavy lifting. But now there's spokes on the wheel. You know, we have a school in the prison for women that's really, it's just me stealing all of the stuff I learned in therapy. We call it curriculum. But there's a lot of things we do, songwriting workshops. And one of the things that happened along the way was me being an assistant for somebody, a chaplain one day that said, hey, we need help over at the hospice jail. And I thought, what the hell is a hospice jail? Well, every state, you know, if you're doing your time and you become terminally ill, you're going to have to go and be taken care of. Mm-hmm. So in Nashville, right next to Riverbend, is another prison called DeBerry, the other death row. And that's where you go if you're terminally ill. So we, as an organization, spend one day a week there. Somebody's there going bed to bed.
Wow.
And it's as heavier as you can imagine. And really, that is just about a musician or musicians going bed to bed to be a friend and listen. Yeah. We're not doing concerts there. Mm-hmm. We're not. Yeah. That's the one place we don't do music. We just sit and listen. And, you know, Nashville's the center of the state, so you might have been diagnosed in Memphis or Knoxville, so you're now coming 4 or 5 hours away.
Yeah.
And your family's not going to see you in your last days. And so that has changed. The interesting part is I stepped into a hospice prison 60 days before I decided it was time to get clean. Or maybe I shouldn't say I decided, whatever. God just came down and lightning bolts up my ass, but broke my heart. And the irony of that to me is not coincidental. It has massively shifted my perspective in that I, on Thursdays, we usually meet with, you know, roughly 100 guys walking through the building all day and just bedside and meeting requests, whatever they need. And it shifted my perspective as I walked into sobriety, because there I was spending time with guys that would, 100 men that would trade places with me on all my worst days added up just to get out of there.
Yeah.
And that quickly showed me how arrogant I am.
Yeah.
Like, oh, my pain. I'm like, yeah, I have pain. I have emotional pain, but I better figure my shit out. And I don't know how and what I'm going to do with that. But it kind of happened, like, it really called a lot of arrogance out.
Wow.
Like, I'm, you know, I walk out and just be depressed or sad.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not saying depression's not real. I'm not saying anxiety's not real. It's very real for me. But it just kind of, for a second, went, all those motherfuckers would trade places with you.
Yes.
Like, come on, man. You're really going to. So it just has helped me. Like, they've helped me more than I've ever done, or us as an organization.
Yeah.
Just by asking me questions. I'm like, they'll ask me just questions about my dogs and music and what's going on out there.
Yeah.
And so that's been a weird thing, to not take pills over and not drink over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just learn.
Isn't that the great gift of service? When we just offer ourselves just to be present with somebody with a story different from ours, somebody early on. It's why I love fishing guys out of the soup. Give me the newcomer every day. So that I can... Partly, I do it so that I can remember what it was like, because I've got a great forgetter. As life gets better, I've got an addict back there that would really love me to forget how bad life can be, so that I can go back. But to give yourself away from, and it's amazing. I spend time. I know you experience this. You too, David. Somebody far. How do I gain strength from somebody weaker than me? But it happens. And it's a two-way gift.
And I think it's when we remember that hopelessness that they are experiencing in that moment. You know, when we felt hopeless, when we felt like we could not see that there was any way this was going to work.
Yeah.
This was great for other people. I was different. You know, I mean, the terminal uniqueness, of course, of, you know, addiction. But when you're in situations where people like Nathan goes into these places and you know, somebody wants to just say, yeah, today's a good day. I got a pencil and now I can you know, I don't know, write a letter or something. I don't know. They may have a rule about that. I don't know, but
no, exactly that.
But it's but today's a good day. You know, that's a big deal. It sounds like, Nathan, to me that, you know, this, I mean, we all talk about gratitude being the cornerstone of recovery all the time, being one of the big pieces we've got to stay in touch with. Does this help you stay in that place of gratitude?
What? Does what help me?
What you do and what you see and observe in people. And I don't mean because, oh, God, thank God it's not me laying there in that situation.
Right. I think it does. You know, if we had a crystal ball, right, we'd all be curious as to what would be in the next half of our life or whatever moments we had left.
Right. Yeah.
If I do get to live the same length again, I know I want to find out what happiness is like.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for real. Mm-hmm. Not some weird idiot, but just like true contentment. Not boredom. I still don't like the word, David. I love you for teaching me about it. But it has helped. I think what's becoming more difficult is, as I learn myself more, the broken parts, et cetera, it's becoming more difficult to walk into jail simply because of the environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. It's like bars smell like beer, prisons smell like sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just hard for me. It's getting harder. It doesn't mean I won't do this.
Right.
I will need a team of people around me to sustain this, because as I kill the narcissist, I don't want to write sad and be sad.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to change. I know things will change for the organization because I'm changing.
Yeah.
And there will always be a need. You know, we live in the United States of America. Incarceration's a $1 billion industry. It's not going anywhere. I'm not going to change it.
Right.
But I can love those people. Just like you can use your gifts, you can use your gifts to love people such as myself who are walking in and through recovery.
Yeah.
There's a place for all of us. But, you know, it's heavy content. It's heavy language. Most times when people come to you guys to talk about what's going on, they're not coming in on a winning streak.
Yeah.
You know, as Brad Warren says, nobody shows up today on a winning streak.
Yeah.
And it's true. You know, when we go into jails, no one's there because this is the dream retirement community in Florida.
That's not the plan came together.
Nobody's plan came together when they go to jail. And my relationship with music has changed.
Yeah.
So I don't want something from anybody anymore.
Yeah.
My agenda, you know, the brass ring is dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, how has sobriety changed your personal relationships?
Well, some of them aren't around anymore. So I guess, which, you know, in a good way. I don't say that resentful, like, F off to somebody, you know?
Yeah.
Obviously, the people that I don't use with aren't around anymore.
Right.
Basic math. That's good. And sometimes I really miss them because I had some fun with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what shit storms I don't have to live through anymore is a good thing.
Yeah.
But so your question was, how has it changed my...
Yeah. Your relationships. Not just who you know, the people with whom you choose to hang, but the way you relate to people, the way you...
I'm interested for the first time in learning how to listen.
Mm.
It's so much more difficult than communicating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not... Again, this is an insult. Some people are very intelligent orators, just great communicators, and they're teachers and pastors and whatever, professors. Even at the best, learning how to be a great listener, that's like master's level shit to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, like great songwriters... They know how to say five lines in one.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to collect a lot of information before you dropped that line.
Right.
So I want to learn how to be a better listener. I'm not great at retaining information. My entire life's about a knee-jerk impulse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So things are changing in that regard. Sitting still. So I'm not putting Klonopin into my body. So if we're at dinner, I'm like, okay, how do I not get antsy with David? And he's going to tell me this story. And it may take 12 minutes in this segment of our time together. Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're dinner with me, it's going to take 20.
20, right. You know, so my mind's constantly going, so my mind's still moving fast, but it's not medicated.
Yeah.
So it's changing the dynamic of my relationships.
Yeah.
And it's fucking weird. Like, I never got the memo.
Yeah.
That, hey, when you get clean, not only every day are you going to feel like you can't breathe, you have to figure out how to do this and not be an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say that was true for the first 90 to 120 days. I was just like... My physical skin was burning.
Yeah.
It was horrible. Yeah. And you have to learn how to, you know, like learn about the brain. What's the brain doing? David was kind enough to one day to show me, this is what happens to your brain. I'm like, holy shit. There's like math and science in this.
Yeah.
So that being, some people didn't want to be around me, right? So some people are like, wait, they never knew. They find out. They were offended. So those people are gone for a while, which is fine. Mm-hmm. They need to. Now I have to learn who I am. So I'm learning, what would you say, just coping skills, communication skills that a lot of times people learn as a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here I am learning them. So I think in every way, shape, and form, hold on for the ride, but don't hold on tight.
Yeah.
Everything's different. Everything's weird. I was telling David, I walked through the airport yesterday as I was flying from New York back to Nashville, and I just thought, like, I'm not like, how are none of these people medicated, and why am I not medicated?
Yeah.
This is weird. Uh-huh. The whole world is weird now to me. Like, why would you not medicate? But, because you don't want to live in pain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is a weird, right? Another paradox. You don't medicate because you don't want to live in pain, but most people medicate with it.
Yeah.
So this is all still new, right? You're only talking to someone who's 18 months deep, and I want to be exposed. Mm-hmm. Some people don't want to talk about this. Mm-hmm. It's really awkward. I would not have wanted to talk about this 2 years ago with somebody who was adamant.
Yeah.
So it's just a
but
weird.
But that's why we do this podcast, because people need to hear that there's a real conversation, that there's some real laughter, there's some real humor in this. Mm-hmm. I mean, dark as it is, there's some funny shit.
It's you really know?
Let's face it. But
you've got to make fun of yourself in this some days, right?
Well, you do. You can't, I mean, it's not all, you know, just, you can't just stay in the sackcloth and ashes and, you know, in this. But that's why we want to talk about it, because it is a journey that there are pieces of this that don't get addressed, that don't get brought out, and that the anonymity may work against us sometimes. I'm totally on board with anonymity when we need to be, and if it gets people help. But the idea that we stay anonymous in our addiction, when telling our story could help other people, then I'm for telling the story, because, I mean, let's face it, all of us have worked in a capacity where people have looked at us and thought, you know, I mean, we were personas. We were a quarter of an inch thick, and we just carried that around in front of us.
I was bright and shiny, man.
Yeah, yeah. You called yourself Saint Nate, which I always thought was nice. But,
well, I think one thing that makes, when you say that, it makes, like, for some people, right, if they're thinking about really stepping into sobriety recovery,
right,
they realize so many people have been hurt, even though they may want to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if I do that, sometimes you get sober and you realize, oh my gosh, the whole town hates me and they all know my secrets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's some kind of weird that's where you get to hit the fuck it button for all the right reasons for the first time in your life.
Yeah.
If they don't like me, so be it. And they probably have really good reason. I really did hurt them. But it's time to, because I think about sometimes when I listen to podcasts, I'm like, that's informative. How do I do that here in the middle of nowhere, Iowa?
Yeah.
Because I don't get to sit in this podcast and hang with us and go to some hip AA meeting in Nashville. Mm-hmm. You literally just hit your fuck it button and say, it's time to love myself and the pieces will fall where they may. And who are now I'm going to find new people that walk a different way with me.
Yeah. Right.
And that's weird, but they're out there.
Yeah.
They're truly, in every town, there's someone that says, I completely fucked my life. I hurt everyone in my life. Yeah. I ruined it all, and I'm still standing, and I want to love you.
Yeah.
That's a weird concept, especially as an addict, to understand that unconditional love is the next step you fall into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Weird. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I didn't mean to steal that and bring it
around. No, that's exactly.
That's awesome.
It's exactly what I wanted to hear.
Well, time has flown here. I do want to, I know that there are going to be listeners to this podcast in the weeks, months, and years that it'll be out there, who are going to want to connect with you, going to want to learn more about Send Musicians to Prison, follow up. What's the best way for them to find you?
Well, if you Google Send Musicians to Prison, there's nothing else rubbing up against it. So just go send.
Nobody else wants your job, man.
Nobody wants my job. I don't blame them. But the website is sendmusicianstoprison.com.
All right. And this could be a donor who wants to support the work, a musician who wants to participate.
Yeah, all of that.
Or somebody who's got a concern about the imprisoned, which those of us, I'm one of those people who calls himself a Christ follower, but when I look at what Jesus actually told us to do, especially in regards to those in prison. I have to admit, I haven't been a very good follower. So if that's your story, this may be the next step for you.
Yeah. Nathan, thank you for being here. It's always a joy and pleasure. And
thanks.
Looking forward to grabbing dinner again.
Can't wait. Thank you, guys. I appreciate your kindness and support within the recovery community. This is a big deal. So it's an honor. Thank you so much.
Fantastic. Okay, hang with us. We'll be back in a minute on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And Nate, I love talking to this guy.
Yeah, you know, when he first walks into the room and he's, you know, tattooed from knuckles to shoulders and he's got the shades and he kind of carries himself. He has kind of a gangster appearance in the, or what is that, kind of street thug a little bit?
Yeah.
And then you spend some time with him. And what you feel is humility, kindness, sweetness.
Yeah, gentleness.
Yeah.
Yeah, truly one of the most gentle, compassionate, empathetic people that I know.
Yeah. And that is, by the way, one of the marks and one of the landmarks of recovery is humility.
Yeah.
Our 12 steppers will know that step 7 in the 12 and 12 begins on page 70 and goes to page 77, and it's all about humility. And one of my first assignments by an early sponsor was, he said, "Buddy, you got a real pride problem," and he prescribed that I should read chapter 7 of the 12 and 12 every day for a year.
Yeah.
Well, and there is much to be gained, isn't there, when we climb off the mountain of our own conceit and our own, you know, pride and self-centeredness, and we turn our attention to others, we join the human race, we become another bozo on the bus, and we see what we can do to serve other people.
Right. And to serve the people that no one else is thinking about.
Yes. And, you know, just personally, I feel that if there is a place for me to go next in recovery, I'm heading to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been a wonderful conversation. The hour has flown. But we will be back soon with another episode. Until then, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
And we're your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli. Music by Rex Schnelli. Theme music by Matt Ulrich. Hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett. Wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.